Sally jibed. Jomling brought his own specialty, 4 kilograms of zampa, which he would take to the higher camps. This roasted barley flour digests easily and provides lasting fuel, though a handful of dry flour can be hard for the uninitiated to get down. Some Sherpas carry a small leather sack in which they mix zampa, tea, butter, and sugar, and knead them into dough balls called pak. Nuts and other ingredients are sometimes added to form a Sherpa version of an energy bar. On April 10th, Paula, Sumio, and Changba prepared a full Japanese dinner, but most meals were not so lavish, consisting of creatively disguised cooked potatoes. One afternoon, when Ed returned from a load carry to Camp 1, he was sorting loads for Camp 1 and 2. "How about Spam tonight, and maybe some wine?" he queried toward the kitchen tent. "Spam?" Sumio said quizzically. Ed nodded enthusiastically to her, then handed a roll of duct tape to a climbing Sherpa who was preparing his snow gaiters. "Spam," Sumio repeated. Pondering intently, she enunciated aloud to herself the other English words she had been practicing. Revision. Tremendous. Awesome. Spam. Araceli perked up. "Did someone say spam? I'm hungry." "Are you angry that we have spam, or are you hungry to have some?" Ed asked her, provoking boisterous laughter from the crew in the kitchen. "No. Hungry," Araceli repeated indignantly, unfazed by the laughter. "I want some food, of course, like I do always." "I think you get angry when you get hungry," Ed joked. Araceli flashed a brief smile, then swatted him. A party of rose finches abandoned their foraging for scraps and fluttered off. Each night, Jomling would check out what the Westerners had cooked and then what the Sherpas had prepared before choosing where to eat. A sip of wine would be hard to pass up, he decided. Evening dinner dress consisted of a down parka, hat, and gloves, donned each afternoon during down-up time, the moment the sun went over the ridge. Base camp visitors noticed that the dining room was as cold as a meat locker, but hunger made the food delicious. After dinner, team members stumbled through the dark to their tents. Despite the cold, porters stood around in the evenings in rubber flip-flop sandals without socks, swearing that they felt fine. "We're on a honeymoon here," Ed said. "Living dormitory style, we don't really have a chance for privacy, but I'd rather have Paula on this trip than write letters to her." Glacier Gadgets. Within a week, the team had regained some strength. "Since we arrived," Roger reported cheerfully, "I've been mending the electronic and solar gadgets that inevitably break while working in tiny cold corners with limited resources. I love it." Already he had fashioned a voltage transformer from parts he had found in the Ozen Toll Bazaar. It took filmmaker Brad Oland a little more time to adjust to glacier life. "I live on the beach in Southern California, and most of my favorite places have jungles and warm weather," he explained. But he had developed a symbiotic rapport with Steve, Robert, and David, each of them dedicated to getting a properly functioning camera to the summit and back safely. The preparation required long hours from Brad, who was responsible for overseeing the complex camera gear. Film and magazines, filters, mat boxes, battery packs, shades, tripods, countless accessories, and the unwieldy camera body itself. The fax machine and satellite phone drew more juice than the jury-rigged solar system could provide, and the generator was frequently needed as backup. In the minus 16-degree Fahrenheit mornings, starting it required 100 pulls on the cord and a magical blend of adjustments to the choke and throttle. The sat phone did get some use. On April 15th, Dr. Charles Warren, one of the few surviving pre-war Everesters, was delighted to receive a call from Audrey and the team wishing him a happy 90th birthday. A member of the 35, 36, and 38 expeditions, Warren discovered the body of Maurice Wilson, the eccentric pilot who in 1934 hoped to reach the summit through fasting and prayer. Warren and his companions committed the remains of the Mad Yorkshireman, as the press dubbed him, to a crevasse below the ice chimney of the North Col. They then sat beneath an overhang and opened his diary, which made for eerie reading. The chat with Warren launched Audrey into after-dinner stories, and she spoke of the film that she and David had scripted and produced on the fate of George Mallory and Andrew Irvine, the two British climbers who disappeared high on Everest in 1924. In her blue Volkswagen Bug, David and Audrey crisscrossed England seeking out other veterans of early Everest attempts. They first visited Captain John Knoll, photographer and filmmaker for the 1922 and 1924 expeditions, in his weatherboard cottage on Rumney Marsh in Kent. Knoll had been an artillery instructor during the Great War, and he advised David to launch a succession of small eggshell bombs high on Everest to excavate the ice and snow, in the hope of finding traces of the two men. Then they motored to Cambridge to interview another nonagenarian, Professor Noel Odell, the last person to see Mallory and Irvine alive. In Bakewell, Sir Jack Longland described how in 1933 his team had discovered an ice axe high on the mountain, which could only have belonged to one of the missing men. Conrad Anker found Mallory's body in 1999, but no one has been able to locate Irvine or their camera. If the camera is found, it might contain film that, preserved by the cold, could be developed. If they had reached the summit, it is inconceivable that there would not be a summit shot to prove it. Ed spoke unequivocally. Even if Mallory and Irvine touched the summit, they didn't make it. That's like swimming to the middle of the ocean. He asserted Sir Edmund Hillary was of the same opinion. The point of climbing Everest, he said, should not be just to reach the summit. I'm rather inclined to think that maybe it's quite important, the getting down. Crowding in the middle of nowhere. By mid-April, Everest Base Camp had filled with 14 expeditions, and their camp stretched for a mile along the rumpled edge of the glacier. The climbers, Sherpas, base camp staff, and government liaison officers brought the base camp population to more than 300. Araceli, accustomed to climbing in small parties on remote routes, was feeling crowded. The approach to here has become commercial. You can even find Snickers to eat. Just 2 hours from base camp. I mean Snickers, the chocolate, not the shoes. She laughed and drew a line around her mouth to show where the chocolate usually becomes smeared. Oh, and you can find the shoes, too. Many of the leaders of these expeditions, David Brashear, Scott Fisher, Rob Hall, Todd Burleson, Pete Athens, and Henry Todd, were eminences in the world of guided climbing, and all were friends. Nonetheless, base camp hummed with an undercurrent of competition between the groups. To make a living climbing, one must be known and recognized. This recognition is achieved mainly by assembling a portfolio of successfully climbed peaks. It is to the guide's advantage professionally to excel where others haven't. Rivalry could be expected. This year, Scott Fisher and Rob Hall's expeditions were the largest. Fisher's Mountain Madness Camp displayed banners advertising Starbucks coffee, and Sherpas painted New Zealand Camp in large letters on a glacial boulder at Hall's campsite. Scott Fisher moved about base camp informally, and his warmth and positive approach infected everyone he met. Ed had climbed K2 with Fisher in 92, and Scott had photographed Ed and Paula's wedding only a few weeks earlier. Scott is freewheeling and almost casual about organization, Ed said. He assumes that the details, how much fuel or how many ropes are needed, will fall into place, and for him, they usually do. Forge ahead, we're going for it, is his motto. He's fun and inspiring, overflowing with energy and enthusiasm. But sometimes I feel he could use some reining in. Ed described Hall as the exact opposite, calculating, meticulous, and organized. Rob is always assessing conditions, the weather, what the clients are doing, asking himself, what if? He uses his incredible drive to help people achieve their dreams and takes joy in a task well done. Ed respected Hall for his climbing expertise and experience, and Scott Fisher was planning to join the two of them on a climb of Manaslu, immediately following Everest. Ed had guided several commercial climbs for Hall's New Zealand company, Adventure Consultants, and he anticipated a long-lasting partnership. Climbers and clients this year had come to Everest with a variety of motives, not all of them clear. Egos and other factors are at work here, Paula said, voicing a concern that Ed had shared earlier. people can become selfish on the mountain and lose sight of what's important. Veteran climbers worry that many clients regard an attempt on Everest as a once-in-a-lifetime chance, predisposing them to push their luck and take risks without the experience that would help them gauge those risks. Out of 7 Everest expeditions, Ed had summited 3 times. Most other experienced guides have even lower summit-to-attempt ratios. Nonetheless, during the approach to the mountain, Scott Fisher expressed a modern and not uncommon sentiment about Everest. I mean, honestly speaking, we have learned how to climb Everest and are building the yellow brick road to the top. It was a road that didn't require a driver's license. The Taiwanese team in particular was underexperienced, though it would be hard to fault them for trying. Audrey Salkeld noted that several of the Taiwanese had lost fingers to frostbite on previous climbs. Imagine gaining your experience for Everest in a country as flat and warm as Taiwan, David said, adding that the Taiwanese climbers reminded him of Mallory and Irvine, sporting and eager, but poorly equipped and in over their heads. The most unusual approach was being made by a lone Swede, 29 years old, named Göran Kropp. Remarkably, Kropp had bicycled from Sweden to Nepal with most of his gear, and he intended to solo Everest in the purest sense of soloing. He would accept no help, not even a cup of tea from others on the mountain. He was hauling his own supplies to the Khumbu Icefall on a route he had found himself. Mindfulness. Jomling stood quietly studying the sprawling impromptu tent city. He spoke with Wang Chu about Geshe Rinpoche's lesson to him on right motivation. Just that day, Wang Chu had lined up a group of young, playfully rebellious base camp support Sherpas. He lectured that he would fine them 10,000 rupees each if they didn't cooperate with Changba, if they weren't helpful to the team, or if they were involved in any extramarital sex at base camp. The Sherpas knew well that the last would offend the deities. Wang Chu was especially concerned that any activity that generated emotions such as anger, jealousy, lust, or pride be avoided when on the mountain, for these would affect one's mindfulness when climbing. Which flag should we fly? Were we to fly one? Robert mused at dinner one night. Jomling pulled out a string of flags he intended to display on the summit: Nepal, India, Tibet, USA, and the United Nations. My parents are from Tibet, but lived for long periods in Nepal and India, where I was raised. I studied and worked for years in the United States. The UN flag might represent me best, and our team as well. Look at us here. He nodded and looked around the dining tent. Most of us are from different countries. He gently passed his hand over another multicolored bundle and carefully untied it. The most meaningful flag for me is this Lungta, the prayer flag. Lungta is actually a wind horse that bears a deity carrying wish-fulfilling gems, and their image is printed on many of the flags. But Lungta also represents the degree of positive spiritual energy and awareness that propels a person. It's their level of divine inner support. The Sherpas say that if their Lungta is high, they will survive most any difficult situation. And if it is low, they can die even while sitting at home. A former Tengboche monk, now working in the United States, described the relationship between Lungta and good luck as similar to that between principle and interest. Cultivating one's Lungta through meditation and right actions helps generate clear thinking, Jomling counseled. He pulled out the other items he hoped to place on the summit. Pictures of his mother and father, neatly framed in a red vinyl wallet. A photo of His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. And an elephant-shaped rattle that his infant daughter selected from a pile of toys. Perhaps significant in light of the Rongbuk Lama's translation of Choma Lungma, Great Elephant Woman. Tenzing Norgay had also taken a small toy to the summit, selected for him by Jomling's sister. If we go for the top on the 9th of May, I feel that my father's spirit will be with us. That's the 10th anniversary of his death, Jomling said. Jomling and I shared a tent, Roger said. And one evening he lent me a signed edition of his father's book, describing the first climb. I read it by flashlight as he recited his prayers. I asked him what he was praying for. He said, "I pray for the safety of all, and that I am worthy to follow in my father's footsteps." It brought tears to my eyes. I always looked forward to chatting with Jomling, because our conversations always went slightly beyond the present. They were philosophical, never involving any shared experience. Pooja at Base Camp. Sherpas and climbers normally won't climb above base camp until the puja ceremony of purification and propitiation has been completed. Each expedition performs its own puja, and they begin by building a handsome chortan-like structure about 8 feet high, which becomes the heart of the Lop So, the worship site. Wang Chu selected an auspicious day from the Tibetan calendar, then summoned an elderly monk from Pangboche. The base camp puja is commonly described as a request for permission to climb the mountain, and for protection and good weather. But its liturgical meaning is much more complex. It is a category of serkim, golden drink offering ritual. Before any new undertaking such as building a house or climbing a mountain, a lama engages the deities and asks for their understanding and toleration for those activities. The morning of the puja, Sherpas and team members brought offerings, bread, rice, barley, and fancier items such as chocolate and whiskey to the Lop So. The lama sat, and two Sherpas poured him tea and made him comfortable. As he read prayers aloud, some of the congregation meditated and prayed, while others moved about informally, as one may at most Sherpa ceremonies. The Sherpa believed that the gods will provide for climbers, or deliver bad luck, even without this ceremony. But like meditation, the ritual is a form of discipline that opens one to receive the wisdom of these gods, empowering the faithful to better recognize beneficial or ominous situations when they arise. The serkim effectively activates the levels of communication and awareness that are needed to succeed. Not only must the climbers and sherpas be purified before setting foot on the mountain, so must their equipment. In one part of the ritual, Sherpas ignite juniper boughs next to the altar. The team and climbing Sherpas then pass their ropes, crampons, ice axes, and other gear through the smoke, bathing it in protective wafts of incense. In the same way that the sweet smell of juniper incense expels odors, the smoke dispels pollution and clears the way for favorable events. The Lama distributed red blessing strings called Sungdi, from Songdu, protection knot, made of thin braided nylon. The team tied one Songdi onto every item of equipment to be left on for the duration of the expedition. We Sherpas believe that Songdi, like the Sungwa amulets, help protect us from the harmful spirits and situations that can push us into a crevasse, off the edge of a narrow ridge, or into the path of an avalanche, said Jomling. But we recognize that these alone are insufficient to save us, of course. Two Sherpas erected a tall prayer flagpole and secured it in a stone enclosure. Seven colorful strings of prayer flags radiated from the top of the pole, their ends anchored nearby. The Sherpas say that if a gorakh, or native raven, lands on the juniper branch on top of the pole during the puja, the expedition will be successful. If the pole breaks or is taken down, bad luck will ensue. To close the ceremony, everyone sang in unison in a gradually rising tone. Go up, may good fortune arise, while slowly elevating right hands full of sampa. Repeating this a third time, they launched the flowers skyward. In a joyous, chaotic moment, all shouted, La Gyalo, may the gods be victorious, and rubbed the flower in one another's hair and on their cheeks to signify that they wished to live until their hair and beards turned white. The Lama poured chang as a communion. Jomling accepted some in his right hand, his left hand held respectfully beneath it. He drank a sip, then ran the rest through his hair to fully incorporate the blessing. The climbers followed, and the offerings were passed out. We all accepted some of the offerings, careful not to take too much, David said. You must not argue on this day, Wong Chu cautioned. They didn't look as if they would. Everyone had begun dancing and drinking, in moderation. Checking the oxygen. Geshe Rinpoche's lesson on mindfulness called for attention to every safeguard. David inspected each of the team's 75 oxygen bottles and every regulator before sending them through the icefall. The bottles were a lifeline, a ticket home. We'll be very exposed above the South Col, where it's like being on the moon, he said, referring to the low atmospheric pressure and likely to hypoxia, which imparts the sensation of not being fully earthbound. Though David expressed unease at the team's dependence on this technological crutch, he handled the bottles with a respect bordering on the religious. In 1996, most climbers preferred the Poisk high-pressure oxygen system. Each of the Russian-made bottles weighs 6.6 pounds when full and provides 6 hours of oxygen flow at 2 liters per minute. The bottles are made of aluminum, wrapped with strands of Kevlar, which help contain the 14,000 pounds of pressure. Though the Poisk system is still in use, some newly available oxygen systems, Top Out and Summit Oxygen, have started winning devotees on the mountain. They're lighter, which means they require less precious energy to carry. Except for Ed, who would be attempting to climb Everest a third time without bottled oxygen, the team would use oxygen when climbing above Camp 3 at 24,000 feet. At Camp 4, they plan to sleep with it on a flow of about a half liter per minute. On summit day, they would each consume 3 bottles. What oxygen does? Dr. Charles Houston, a pioneer of modern high-altitude physiology studies and an advisor on the film, would often explain that when working muscles don't receive enough oxygen, they can go anaerobic and begin burning fuel without oxygen. But this results in acidosis, which the body doesn't tolerate for long. Breathing bottled oxygen increases arterial oxygen and thereby hemoglobin saturation, which brings more oxygen to hungry tissues. And with more oxygen available, the extreme urge to breathe is reduced, giving both the feeling and reality of more energy. Oxygen was first used in the 1920s, but with criticism from high mountain purists. Even though it was not clear at the time that climbing Everest without it would be possible. Until 1946, that is, when Houston oversaw Operation Everest, in which 4 human subjects in a decompression chamber were taken slowly over a period of 1 month to the decreased atmospheric pressure of Everest's summit. There, 2 of the subjects were able to perform light work for a short period. Houston pointed out that if Mount Everest at 28 degrees north latitude were located at the latitude of Alaska's Mount Denali, 63 degrees, it would have the barometric pressure of a peak at least another 500 feet higher, possibly making it unclimbable without bottled oxygen. For emergencies, the team would have access to a novel item, an inflatable hyperbaric bag made of airtight reinforced vinyl into which a very sick patient could be placed. It does the opposite of Houston's chamber. As the bag is continually pumped up by helpers, the air, and thus oxygen, pressure, can be increased to that of lower altitudes. Afflicted climbers can improve their condition to the point where they are able to descend with minimal assistance. Altitude, Sherpas, and geese. Filmmaker Steve Judson sat on a rock one morning a few days after the arrival at base camp. It's humbling. When I feel so bad to watch the Sherpas scampering around as if they were at sea level. Aside from having a longer opportunity for acclimatizing, many wonder if the Sherpa and other highland peoples are physiologically different from the rest of us. Physical anthropologist Dr. Cynthia Beale believes the Sherpa may possess a gene that allows more efficient oxygen delivery, giving them an advantage over lowlanders. One part-time Himalayan resident, the bar-headed goose, is an even more remarkable acclimatizer in this regard than the Sherpa or the Tibetan people. High-altitude physiologist Dr. Robert Brownie Shaney is impressed that these birds can winter in the marshes of India, then, without the advantage of gradual acclimatization, get up and fly over the Himalaya to their summer breeding areas high on the Tibetan plateau. Like all birds, bar-headed geese have a remarkably efficient one-way flow of air into their lungs, which eliminates wasted breathing. But they also possess a hemoglobin molecule in the red blood cells that distinguishes them genetically from their lowland bird relatives. This hemoglobin has a greater capacity for picking up oxygen in conditions of low oxygen pressure and is able to unload that oxygen to the tissues that are starved for it, Shaney explained. Thomas Jukes, a biologist who has studied bar-headed geese, suggests that one day, Himalayan climbers might be able to receive transfusions of a similar genetically engineered hemoglobin before ascending to high altitudes. Camp by camp siege. Most teams place their series of four mountain camps at locations that have been used for the past 40 years, sites that were initially selected for their relative safety from avalanche, rockfall, wind, and movement of the glacier. Each expedition groups its tents closely together, though these may be up to a few hundred yards from another expedition's camp. After a route has been found through the Khumbu Icefall, the goal of every team is to establish and fully stock their four camps with supplies, so that the summit push can be made quickly from base camp or camp two. This process generally takes a month or longer. During the first week on the mountain, the Sherpas typically rise early, and in a couple of hours carry a 40 to 50 pound load to Camp 1 at 19,500 feet, then return to base camp. When much of the gear for the higher camps has been carried to Camp 1, the gear is shuttled to Camp 2 at 21,300 feet. There the Sherpas set up a smaller version of base camp, Advance Base Camp, with a cook tent, dining tent, and individual tents. Most of the climbers' rest time above base camp is spent here. When acclimatized, they can climb directly from base camp to Camp 2, and Camp 1 mainly becomes a way station for gear. At Camp 3, 24,000 feet, the climbers need only two tents. The Sherpas do not stay here, but generally go directly from 2 to 4. Camp 4, the uppermost camp, is situated at 26,000 feet on the South Col, a broad saddle between Lhotse and Everest. The South Col is higher than all but 17 of the world's highest peaks, placing it in the death zone, a poorly defined but easily recognized altitude where climbers know they must limit their time as their condition deteriorates fairly quickly above this altitude. Here, six tents are erected, but until the night before the summit push, Camp 4 is little more than a place to store oxygen and equipment. The day before the summit attempt, the team climbs from Camp 3 to Camp 4, arriving there in the early afternoon. Here they rest for a few hours and rehydrate themselves or brew up before departing about midnight for the summit. They generally reach the balcony at the base of the southeast ridge around sunrise, then continue along the ridge to the south summit. From there, they negotiate a traverse to the Hillary Step, a 40-foot-high wall of rock and ice which, when surmounted, puts them within an hour of the summit. Hopefully, the climbers will return to Camp 4 before dark, after 18 hours of climbing. Camp 4 was Camp 6 in the early 1950s, and Camp 7 then was placed on the balcony at 27,600 feet. Only a few believed that climbers could reach the summit and return to the South Col in a day. Though physically just as difficult, the summit push may be physiologically easier now. Climbers seem more willing to climb longer in exposed situations. Camp 4 is needed, but it's basically a rest and rehydration stop, Ed noted. You get there tired, make camp, spend time and energy making a meal, and after not getting any sleep, you repeat the process in the morning. Acclimatizing does not mean adjusting to climate. Why all the moving up and down before the climb? The Sherpas and team are leapfrogging supplies from camp to camp, but they are also acclimatizing. Moving too high too fast can strain this process and lead to high-altitude illnesses. Acclimatization is time-consuming. Most experienced Himalayan mountaineers recommend ascending no more than 2,000 feet a day in order to give the body time to adjust to lower pressure and oxygen levels. It's remarkable that humans can adjust to altitude to the extent they do. Without supplemental oxygen, a person used to living at sea level would collapse within a half hour and die soon afterward if suddenly taken to 20,000 feet. At the summit of Mount Everest, where the available oxygen is a third that at sea level, the same person would lose consciousness almost immediately and die within minutes. The 3,000 vertical feet from Camp 4 to the summit is supremely difficult. At extreme altitudes, physical performance decreases at an accelerating rate. Even though Everest is only 778 feet higher than K2, representing a difference in barometric pressure of only 3%, there is a disproportionately much greater drop in the body's ability to obtain and utilize oxygen. Everest is in a class by itself. Houston stressed that the Everest summiter must climb the last thousands of feet relying on courage, determination, and drive, rather than on more acclimatization. Indeed, after weeks above 20,000 feet, additional gains in terms of acclimatization are marginal. In Operation Everest, Houston found that humans deteriorate above this height even in the comfortable conditions of a decompression chamber. Dr. Peter Hackett, executive director of the Institute for Altitude Medicine and an expert in high-altitude physiology, describes the slow degeneration that the team faces as a slow death by starvation, dehydration, suffocation, and exposure. Although they need to climb high for acclimatization, the team must limit their stay there. Much of the recent success on Everest has depended upon climbers fine-tuning this balance, acclimatizing just enough to summit before they are too debilitated to do so. Individuals respond differently to altitude, but this is difficult to predict. Those whose bodies naturally cry out for more oxygen as they ascend actually acclimatize better than those whose bodies don't react as much to the decreased oxygen. "We know little about why this is so," Houston once said. "But the major factors determining one's response to high altitude are the speed of ascent, the altitude reached, one's health at the time, and genetic or other influences. The fact is, we don't know how best to acclimatize," Houston continued with characteristic candor. "On the one hand, thousands of mountaineers have used the time-honored method of climbing slowly upward and descending to sleep. The siege tactic known as climb high, sleep low. Alpine style is the other method, in which climbers live at base camp and scramble up nearby peaks, going a little higher each day, getting tough and acclimatized. When the weather and individual conditions match, they go for the summit in one shot. Dozens of people have summited both Everest and K2 from base camp in this style too," Houston added, "but some have died. It may be a riskier technique. Whether climbers suffer brain damage from the hypoxia of a prolonged stay at altitude is hotly debated. Some have, the physiologists note, but usually these victims also experience severe altitude illness, hypothermia, exhaustion, or trauma." The team was fully aware of Houston's straightforward advice on acclimatizing. Take time to go high, don't overexert or overeat, drink extra water, and listen to your body. And, as John Ling reminded them, listen to Mio Lang Sangma, the Maiden of the Wind. In depth, Greg McGillivray, IMAXing the Mountain. "Everyone told me the IMAX camera was too big and heavy to take to the top of Mount Everest, that it was an impossible goal," said producer and director Greg McGillivray, "but I was steadfast. We had to shoot the summit with full IMAX images. Those shots were the key to the entire film." McGillivray went to the best technicians at IMAX Corporation's engineering department to design a new camera for more than a year. Kevin Kowalczyk and Gord Harris worked to build a lighter camera that was small enough for the Sherpas to carry all the way to the top of the mountain and that would withstand Everest's harsh conditions. David Brashears laid out the specifications. The weight of the camera body could not exceed 26 pounds. The camera would have to withstand minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit temperatures for 24 hours, and then operate reliably with the flip of a switch. Large accessible knobs and lens mounts would be needed to allow an exhausted camera operator to film with potentially impaired motor and thinking skills. At IMAX Corporation headquarters in Toronto, the engineering team began with an IMAX Mark II camera model, modified the lightweight and durable magnesium body, then simplified the electronics and removed the 8-pound flywheel. "We turned a 96 Chevy into a 56 Chevy," said cameraman and technical supervisor Brad Oland, "while reducing its weight by half. At exactly 25 pounds, the Everest model weighed in at less than half the Mark II's normal weight. Extreme cold congeals lubricants and makes film brittle, so the engineers built in a hand crank for loosening up the system and used a lubricant that remains viscous down to minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Conventional batteries fail in the extreme cold, and so the camera needed to be powered by a non-rechargeable lithium battery pack. When fully loaded with lens and 500-foot film magazine, the camera package weighed in at 48 pounds. After testing the camera system in a blizzard on a New Hampshire mountaintop, IMAX rented a cold test chamber used by the defense industry to put the camera through its paces. "When we stepped in, it was minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit," Brashears said, "giving us an opportunity to test our expedition's down clothing, too, which we were wearing. They loaded film barehanded, plugged in the battery, and turned the camera on. It performed flawlessly every time. That was the first moment I thought to myself, we can really do this." In 1995, MacGillivray sent Brashears and Kowalczuk to field test the camera in Nepal. With 40 porters, they trekked over 160 miles, ascending and descending more than 80,000 vertical feet. They left the camera outside overnight, on rocky outcrops, with only a nylon cover for protection. "In the mornings, I turn the camera on," Brashears said. In 27 days, not a single scene was lost to camera or battery malfunction. But the 1996 film expedition was not without its technical challenges. In one nerve-wracking incident, the IMAX camera broke down on the mountain. At base camp, Brad Oland worked 48 hours straight to get it repaired and running again for the team on the mountain, said MacGillivray. But at the summit, the camera worked perfectly. "Our team got 3 minutes of historic images, and I used every second in the film." Charles S. Houston, M.D. What happens at altitude? It's a law of nature. Without oxygen, we die. At high altitude, oxygen is in short supply, and simply getting a good breath is a challenge to any climber. Oxygen density at varying altitudes is a function of another basic law, gravity. Air has weight. At sea level, it is compressed by the blanket of air above it and is comfortably dense. At high altitudes, air pressure is lower and air is consequently thinner. Adjusting to reduced oxygen levels requires some rapid physiological changes and is followed by slower long-term changes. The first change is obvious. We breathe harder to get more oxygen into our lungs. Breathing harder provides the lungs with more oxygen, but also causes problems with loss of too much carbon dioxide. As a byproduct of metabolism, we need to exhale carbon dioxide, a swift and sensitive agent, for adjusting the acidity of blood. Overbreathing washes out carbon dioxide, causing low acidity, or alkalosis, an abnormal condition that cannot be tolerated for long. As we breathe faster and deeper, the heart also beats faster and harder, pumping more blood per beat and per minute. The small capillaries and tissues become more permeable when short of oxygen, causing fluid to leak into the tissues and concentrating the red blood cells, thereby increasing the blood's oxygen content. These changes, increased breathing, higher output from the heart, and the concentration of blood, are struggle responses. They protect the body from oxygen deprivation or hypoxia, but they can't be sustained for long without provoking potentially life-threatening symptoms. Given time, acclimatization is effective, but if we go too high, too fast, the struggle responses may be inadequate and acclimatization too slow to provide us with enough oxygen, and we are likely to get mountain sickness. Though we speak of several forms, they are all consequences of hypoxia. Hypoxia can lead to acute mountain sickness, which in turn can develop into the more serious high-altitude pulmonary edema, HAPE, or even high-altitude cerebral edema, HACE, an early but ominous sign of a more serious brain disturbance caused by altitude. HACE can be difficult to recognize because it weakens the higher functions of the brain, judgment, perception, memory, and will. Chapter 4. The Mountain That Rose from the Sea. Climbers first viewed the Khumbu Icefall from the Nepal side in 1950, the year that Dr. Charles Houston joined the first group of foreigners to visit Khumbu. The group's journals, he said, consisted largely of superlatives expressing Khumbu's beauty and grandeur, but their glimpse of the icefall itself was sobering. For a long time, we looked at the terrible icefall coming out of the western Khum and decided that the approach would be very dangerous and difficult, perhaps impossible. This maze of crevasses, seracs, and ice blocks the size of apartment buildings has claimed more lives than any other part of the mountain. Avalanches routinely thundered down from the Lhotse Wall and Everest's southwest face and wash over the glacier as they did in 2014 and 2015. Chunks of ice weighing hundreds of tons shift and tumble without warning. Seemingly bottomless crevasses open and close, albeit more slowly. Looking up at the Khumbu Icefall from base camp, one feels one is about to be deluged by a tidal wave of gigantic ice cubes. The 1963 American Everest Expedition, sponsored in part by the National Geographic Society, experienced the first death of a foreign climber on the Nepal side of Everest. Dr. Gil Roberts was leading the second rope through the icefall, 10 yards behind the climbers ahead, when a 30-foot freestanding wall of ice fell over and entombed his good friend Jake Breitenbach. Gil was partly buried, but freed himself and began digging out others. With great emotion, Gil had to cut the rope that led to Jake, hopelessly buried beneath the serac. Then, as he helped the injured survivors descend through the icefall, he heard a cry that sounded nearly human. It was a gorok, the bird believed to be the auspicious bearer of human souls, flying up from a crevice in the ice next to them. Jake's body emerged from the Khumbu Glacier in 1970, and a fellow team member, Barry Bishop, took him for burial on the ridge beyond Tengboche. Bishop had summited with the 63 expedition and later served for many years on the National Geographic Society's Committee for Research and Exploration. He and his son Brent were the first American father and son to both summit Everest. In 1994, Bishop died in a car accident en route to receive an award from the American Himalayan Foundation honoring this achievement. At Tengboche, some of Bishop's ashes are now buried alongside Jake Breitenbach. A scary kind of place. The team would need the last 3 weeks of April to establish and stock the upper camps, but first, they would need to get through the icefall. Customarily, the route through the icefall is found and maintained by a single team, which is paid for the service by the other teams. In the early spring before most expeditions had arrived at base camp, an international party led by Scottish climber Mal Duff explored the icefall for the safest and most direct route through it. They were followed by rope teams carrying ladders, 6,000 feet of rope, and plenty of hardware. 100 ice screws and 100 pickets, 1-meter-long aluminum stakes, used to anchor the fixed ropes and the ladders over the crevasses. The danger from falling is greatly reduced by the use of fixed ropes, which are secured along exposed sections of the route for the duration of the season. Climbers have an ascending device, or a carabiner, connected to their harness, and they clip this to the rope. They slide it up the rope as they climb, and the carabiner stops them if they fall. More than 60 8-foot aluminum ladder sections may be used in the icefall. For a horizontal bridge, up to 4 sections are bolted together or lashed with plastic rope. Over the middle of the crevasse, many climbers lower to a crawl because of the unnerving bounce. A ladder like that is a little wow, Araceli recounted excitedly. I look down and then at my small rope. If I fall, someone will catch me and take me out, I hope. Before her first Everest attempt last year, Araceli climbed some daunting vertical routes in Yosemite. By comparison, the icefall was a snap, technically, but it gave her pause. There's a place where sometimes you see your friends over there and get near them, on the same level, and then you go down again, she added. It's a labyrinth of shifting turquoise ice. This is the challenging and fun part of the climb. But you must be there at not the wrong time. Ed recalled a precarious stretch he encountered in 94. To get up one ice headwall, we used 9 ladders tied end to end, with guy lines leading off to the sides like trapeze wires. That was a crazy ride. It curved over backward near the top and swayed horribly. The lower side of the crevasse dropped daily, and each morning Ed and his team found the topmost ladder another 5 feet below the upper lip. Each day a Sherpa would strap extra ladder sections to his back, crawl up the tottering construction, and lash them to the top end. Once the icefall ladders are fixed, they require daily maintenance to accommodate movement, especially later in the season. Screws melt out. The glacier moves. Crevasses widen, and sometimes whole sections of the glacier collapse and take out the route. That is exactly what happened on April 18, 2014, when a major avalanche on the icefall cost 16 climbing Sherpas their lives. Climbing through the icefall is like trying to cross a busy interstate at night dressed in black clothes, wrote Jim Litch, a climber and a doctor at the Himalayan Rescue Association's Periche Clinic. The difference is that instead of doing it once, climbers make the trip over and over to the point that it becomes an acceptable risk. On April 8th, when Ed first climbed through it, he remarked that it was in the best shape and location he had ever seen it, due partly to the heavy winter and spring snowfall. No matter the conditions, climbers should travel it only in the early morning, when the ice bridges and seracs are more solidly frozen. As summit day approached, the Sherpas climbed empty from Camp 2 to Camp 3, on the Lhotse face, picked up loads and carried them to the South Col, then returned to Camp 2 the same evening. Like the climbers, the Sherpas enjoy the challenge and competition, and many are as strong as the best climbers. People who climb Everest boast of their success, but few of them mention that 95% of the work, the grunt work, was done by Sherpas, Ed commented. I've noticed that the climbers and clients who talk most about reaching the summit tend to be those who avoid the day-to-day work needed to get them there. They're often the ones who get in trouble, too. Ed doesn't ask the Sherpas to do anything he wouldn't. He works to create a rapport, cross-checks plans with them, and lets them know that he's not simply ordering them around. I know I'll see them again next year, and I want to maintain a good working relationship and to continue having a good time. David and Robert created opportunities to film whenever they could. They set up the bulky camera in the icefall, though they were unnerved by the conflicting demands of both moving quickly through the treacherous landscape and waiting for the proper light. They got the shots they needed despite one mishap. Quick! A cloud is coming! We need to use this light! David said to Robert during one precarious camera setup. I tried to concentrate, but somehow turned the loading dial the wrong way, Robert recalled. The camera ran up to speed, but the registration pins weren't positioned properly and they perforated new holes in the film. The camera jammed, making a real mess of the film. It was like celluloid confetti. Only a few days earlier at base camp, the film crew had been shooting a time-lapse shot of golden clouds flowing past a silhouetted peak. The camera made an unusual noise, then began to smoke. Brad immediately thought of its magnesium construction. The camera itself could ignite. Acting quickly, he removed the lens and a ring of electrical smoke blew out at him from inside the body of the camera. He traced the smoke to a faulty, inexpensive chip, a component they had been assured was bomb-proof. Fortunately, Brad Oland had brought a replacement with him, and the camera was running again in several hours. The following day, several pairs of the team's crampons were stolen from the base of the ice fall, where the climbers routinely left them while walking about on the rubble at base camp. David called a meeting of the team leaders to alert them, to request their return should they turn up, and to discuss the meaning of the theft in the context of the long tradition of mountaineering etiquette. At camp later, he told Steve Judson that he felt the incident was a bad omen. Rescue. The ice fall crevasses are so deep that when Sherpas look into their blue-black depths, they often joke that they're looking into America. Falling into one is referred to as getting a visa to the U.S. On April 8th, a radio call announced that there had been an accident in the Western Coombe. An unroped Sherpa on Rob Hall's team had fallen through a snow bridge and into a hidden crevasse between Camp 1 and Camp 2. Miraculously, he had landed on a peninsular ledge, surrounded by darkness and depth. The Sherpa was pulled out by his teammates and was stranded at Camp 1 for 2 days with a suspected broken femur. The complicated evacuation involved 35 people, including 6 Everest team Sherpas, and took most of a day. From base camp, the Sherpa was airlifted to Kathmandu. He was one of 5 sent by Rob Hall to establish Camp 2, before Hall had arrived at base camp, and before Hall's base camp puja had been conducted. Some Sherpas connected the accident to this breach of tradition. About 2 weeks later, Audrey reported that lights could be seen bobbing through the icefall. Nawang Dorji, a Sherpa on Scott Fisher's team, had become sick and was assisted down by fellow team members on April 24th. His symptoms of rales caused by fluid in the lungs resembled those of severe pulmonary edema, but when his condition didn't improve, doctors suspected it was complicated by other factors. Nawang remained in critical condition at the Parache Clinic at 14,000 feet until he was evacuated to Kathmandu by helicopter when the weather finally cleared enough to fly on April 26th. Audrey had also reported that a member of Mal Duff's party had experienced a suspected heart attack on April 20th while climbing, and that he had been evacuated to Kathmandu. 10 days later, a Danish climber on Mal Duff's team was injured while descending from Camp 2 and suffered broken ribs. David and Robert were nearby and found that the man could walk, albeit slowly and with difficulty. Robert and Thielen Sherpa elected to help him through the icefall, where he was met by team members. The team feared the likelihood of more accidents below Camp 1. Many of the Taiwanese staggering through the icefall didn't appear to belong on Everest. Some didn't know how to tie their crampons on, and had difficulty walking on them correctly. The South Africans, too, were having problems. During the trek in, their 3 most experienced climbers resigned over concerns about safety, and described the expedition leader, Ian Woodall, as extremely unprofessional. For the remainder of the season, the South African team did not share the spirit of cooperation that is nearly always found in the mountains. Henry Todd, leading his own group, was concerned enough to give ice climbing instructions to South African Deshun Dazel, who had never been on snow and ice before. It turned out that Ian Woodall had never confirmed her permit as an expedition member. David detected a certain look, shared by the inexperienced clients. Wearing the right gear, but out of place and awkward in it, he made a point of taking time to speak with the ones he met, urging them to be extremely careful and reminding them of the more dangerous parts of the climb. Guides for the commercial groups, aware of many of their clients' inexperience, suggested establishing a rule about turnaround time. After some discussion, it was agreed that on summit day, if clients had not summited by 2 p.m., they would have to return to the South Col. No guide would want to gather clients straggling back to Camp 4 in the dark. On April 30th, the team returned to base camp. Camps 2 and 3 were established. Camp 4 and the South Col had been stocked with oxygen, food, and other supplies. They were as acclimatized as they would get, and now needed as much as 5 days to rest and to regain some of the weight they had lost higher on the mountain. One evening, a raucous party was held at Rob Hall's dining tent. Some climbers privately questioned why someone would have a party before the summit attempt. Others could understand the need to let off some steam. The combined tension of weather, logistics, crowding, and the dangerous mission of climbing the mountain had been building. For Hall, the stakes may have been raised. Neither he nor any of his party had reached the summit the year before, and this year he had two additional clients. At dinner, the team seemed relaxed. Each had reached Camp 3 and had returned safely. The interesting part for me is the missing mountain. What erosion took away, Roger commented one evening with playful irony. Everyone here seems awestruck by the stuff that was left behind. This entire range lay beneath the ocean. Even the summit of Everest contains rocks that were formed of sediments from an ancient sea or seas. The 450-million-year-old marine limestone deposits on Everest may have been to the tops of mountain ranges and back to the sea more than once, and 10 million years hence the eroded remnants of Everest may again be on the bottom of the Indian Ocean. In as soon as several thousand years from now, a mere geological instant, it is likely that Everest will cease to be the world's tallest mountain, Roger explained at an impromptu lecture that followed dinner one evening. At some point, its top will succumb to gravity and simply fall down the slope in a big landslide. Because they are so dynamic, the Himalaya are one of the Earth's great laboratories for the study of mountain building and erosion. In Khumbu, the geology is immediately apparent, particularly above the tree line where there is little vegetation to conceal the cliffs and rocks. Standing near base camp, Roger seemed to say, "Now it all makes sense," as he turned and surveyed the stony mountainscape. Jomling saw him bend over to pick up yet another wayside rock. "Put that down," Jomling jibed. "We may be carrying some of your scientific devices to the South Call for you, but don't ask us to start carrying rocks." Roger Billam has helped pioneer the use of GPS receivers to measure the movement of the surface of the Earth. Teams of students from the University of Colorado and Caltech, led by Jean-Philippe Avouac, along with local scientists from Nepal, have now obtained considerable information about the processes of tectonic collision in the Nepal Himalaya. With the use of signals from GPS satellites, either recorded continuously or for several days, and repeated at yearly or greater intervals, the relative positions of these points throughout the mountains have been measured to an accuracy of 1 to 3 millimeters. A permanently fixed unit was installed when the expedition passed through Namcha Bazaar, but GPS measurements have now been made at hundreds of points throughout the Himalaya. The observations of vertical and horizontal motion are then combined with information about microseismicity and geological structure. By mapping all of this, we can infer the style and rate of deformation at depth, and in turn gain insight into the potential of future earthquakes, Roger explained. Robert and David accompanied Roger up Kala Patar, or Black Rock, a relatively small peak overlooking base camp. Kala Patar rocks are covered with a dark layer of desert varnish, caused by thousands of years of solar radiation. When broken open, the rock is actually a light-colored granite. There, Roger activated one of the solar-powered GPS receivers to measure and calculate the distances to Lukla, Periche, Dingboche, and Tengboche, where GPS readings were taken during the expedition. The climbers would take a sixth reading on Everest South Col, an unwieldy but valuable location. Khumbu's valleys are covered with loose glacial moraine and their sides are too steep for the receiver. The relatively flat South Col has excellent sky visibility and is located on bedrock that is free of snow. "As long as someone else will haul the device up there, I'm delighted," Roger said. The 8 GPS navigational satellites broadcast on the same frequency, but to a stationary receiver, their frequencies appear to shift because they are moving relative to each other, like the changing sound of a high-speed train whistle when it passes an observer. The GPS receiver is programmed with satellite locations and contains a very precise clock, which allows the unit to distinguish between satellites and thereby calculate its location. The GPS measurements showed that the Namcha Bazaar is converging on Rongbuk Monastery, directly north of Everest, at the rate of nearly a half inch per year. Our measurements indicate that the Indian plate is sliding northward beneath Tibet, along an inclined plane roughly 10 miles below Namcha, Roger explained. Above that plane, rocks scraped off the Indian plate are caught in the squeeze between India and Tibet and are thrust upward. Great earthquakes are inevitable. In the past 3 decades, GPS measurements have established that convergence between southern Tibet and northern India varies from a low of 12 millimeters a year in the west to a high of 18 millimeters a year